We are here in East Lecture Hall. We're going to have a presentation by the Yes Men.
No, we don't have any hypnosis planned. At least I don't. Yeah, we're still waiting. We're missing Andy, actually. I don't know what. Has anybody seen a guy wandering around looking kind of lost? Oh, there he is. Hey, it's two. Yeah, well, when he gets here, he might not make it. This is the place. This is it.
All set?
Yeah, we're set. We're set when you are.
Thanks, everyone, for coming along this evening. I know there was something else happening earlier on, so we've crammed two events into one evening. I'd just like to say a couple of words before we start. A thank you to Barbara Hillman, Humanities, Arts and Cultural Studies here at Hampshire College, and also to Liz Miller, currently at Smith College. Liz, forgive me, the name of the organization that helped us out this evening?
The Motion Picture Committee.
The Motion Picture Committee at Smith College. Thank you to them also. I'd just like to say a couple of comments. I don't think it's lost on any of us right now that we're at a stage of unprecedented concentration in media ownership here in the States and elsewhere. One critique that's developed out of this that I've been partial to is in a book called No Logo by Naomi Klein. I'm sure some of you know the book, which is in some ways has become a lightning rod for criticisms based on or drawn from and through corporate branding, corporate logos, and for concerns about global capitalism and social justice issues. I think it's telling that Naomi Klein is on record now as saying that she has been approached by business leaders to do talks, that No Logo has been interpreted in some quarters as basically giving a G up to the business community to explain to them how they're doing things wrong and how they could do things right, which to me undermines the critique, but also speaks to the hubris of contemporary capitalism. So that's one reason why I'm here tonight, and I hope you're going to join me in welcoming Andy and Mike from the Yes Men.
Well, thanks for coming out tonight. We just went to an amazing performance over in the library. That was quite remarkable. Thanks for whoever had a part in that. Thanks for putting it on, and thanks to Matt for kind of coordinating, and also to Liz and Baba and all of you whose fees in some way probably contribute to our being here as well. And so we're here tonight basically to tell you a little story about what we have been up to as Yes Men, I suppose. After we give a short slide presentation and show you a few video clips, we'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have and even questions that you don't have. So on that note, we'll begin. If anybody also wants to just interrupt or interject in the middle of this because what we say upsets you or bothers you in some way, feel free.
Or if it's completely inscrutable and you have no idea what we're talking about, which could happen.
We'll maybe send the other way and explain some basic concepts that you probably already know about, but that inform the kind of work that we do and give us the reason for doing a lot of things that we do. The main concept is one called liberalization, which has two components. It's a process of taking public resources and putting them into the private sector, selling off public resources, making them private in order to supposedly bolster efficiency and make them used better. And it's making economic decisions be at the top of all decisions, trumping social welfare questions, health questions, and even questions of national sovereignty. There's a few different forms that liberalization takes. One form is pretty obvious. There are gentler forms, momentarily gentler forms. The International Monetary Fund is another way of opening up public resources to the private sector. The International Monetary Fund was established by the United States shortly after World War II, and it essentially gives loans to poor countries in exchange for liberalization, because liberalization is perceived as economic health. So it basically takes resources out of the public sector, puts them in the private sector. And another component is the WTO, another element of the liberalization of the world's resources is the WTO, which is basically a system of law which enables countries or corporations to sue other countries for violations of its rules, which basically say that nothing can supersede commercial interests. And next slide.
So the results of a lot of this this activity, the results of liberalization, often look sort of like this slide right here. We have environmental problems that are exacerbated or enhanced by liberalization, and a specific example would be, let's say, the case that Venezuela brought before the WTO, I believe it was in 1997, where they wanted the United States to do away with environmental laws that were protecting clean air. And the reason they wanted that is because they wanted to continue selling this very dirty fuel that they were producing to the United States and to other countries without being without being penalized financially. And the WTO heard their decision, and they ruled against the United States Clean Air Act, and the United States had to buy the dirty fuel from Venezuela or be forced to pay a big fine for having those environmental rules. So, first of all, the environment is a big target of WTO policies because it gets in the way of free trade. Let's have another slide.
And only one environmental law that's been challenged in the WTO has stood up.
And then another sort of high-profile decision is what they call the bananas decision, where the World Trade Organization heard a case brought before it by the United States where the United States thought that Europe should be forced to buy the cheapest bananas available, which came from Central American producers, places like Chiquita, despite the fact that they had deplorable human rights records. And at the time, Europe was favoring some of the Caribbean states that were their former colonies as kind of almost like a way of, I guess, helping them out after many, many years of colonization. And so places like Jamaica, where they were producing bananas slightly more expensive because the workers had better benefits and better conditions to work in, suddenly found themselves out of business because Europe was forced to buy bananas from Chiquita instead of paying slightly more for the bananas from its Central island producers. Let's have the next slide. So in another high-profile case, Europe did not want to import, they wanted to ban hormone-treated beef. Now, there's been many studies that prove that hormones give you lots of problems for your health. Deregulation of hormones and ingesting hormones in large quantities can cause, among other things, miniaturization of the testicles. It's caused miniaturized penises in alligators. And it causes even worse problems for female health, and specifically female reproductive health. And so Europe wanted to ban hormone-treated beef, but the United States brought a case before the WTO, and the WTO struck down that rule and said that basically any country that's participating in the World Trade Organization system can't let health regulations get in the way of free trade. Unless, of course, it's proven beyond a doubt, according to the standards of the WTO, that these things are dangerous. And who's in control of the standards of the WTO? Well, it's the WTO. So it's kind of like letting the foxes watch the hen house. Let's have the next slide.
And to give you an idea where the WTO is going now, at this point in history, some new agreements are taking shape and becoming law, including the General Agreement on Trade and Services. So far, we've talked about products and the way products are protected from any legislation not concerned with the bottom line. The same will apply to services. So, for example, a company could sue a country for providing healthcare because healthcare competes with the company which can produce it as well, supposedly. Same with education, water provision. In the case of water, there was a case where Bolivia tried to privatize its water resources, and the result was such a catastrophe that the people rose up and rioted for a few days. The government backed down and renationalized the water. Under GATS, that would be impossible.
And this is actually what's going to be a big part of the upcoming ministerial in Cancun in September. So I don't know if anybody's planning on going there to pay them a visit. We're actually going to try to register as an NGO in Cancun and attend and have our say. Try to. We don't expect that they'll let us in, but it's worth a try.
Next slide. Under these conditions, which are basically, to sum up, about these conditions of liberalization, which are about giving freedom to corporations to do what they see fit to do, it's not surprising that these corporations, which are, of course, the richest entities on earth, are simply getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. So you see trends over the last 20 years when liberalization has been at its strongest. You see trends where inequality has doubled between rich and poor, more and more poor people. Now half the world's population lives on less than $2 a day, things like this. All of this is on the increase, and it's not that surprising. Next slide, that given these conditions, huge numbers of people in the third world have been protesting and rioting for about a decade and a half, and many protesters have even been killed. It's a very serious matter, and it's been that way for quite a while.
And we can have the next slide. And of course, many of you are familiar with this chemical warfare scene here. This is becoming more and more common on the streets. This was, of course, a slide from Seattle in 1999 when that third world protest spilled over into the first world. And you had a lot of organizations coming to protest these processes of liberalization, process the World Trade Organization. This is where they were having the ministerial meeting in 1999. That's the meeting where all the delegates from the 145 member countries come together and meet to discuss further liberalizing or further breaking down national laws that protect people. All right, and let's have the next slide.
Chemical warfare.
Yeah, we got involved in this process as well, and so we've been going to some of these protests because it seems like this should be something that all of us are concerned about. This is a scene from Genoa. This is actually the G8, so it wasn't the WTO per se, but a lot of the people who are invested in issues of anti-economic globalization were showing up to have their say, where the eight largest economic nations in the world were getting together to have a meeting and decide many of the ways that the course of liberalization was going to be played out. And what you see down there is another big cloud of gas, again, chemical warfare taking place on the streets in response to what was a very large, peaceful protest.
Peaceful up to that moment. And
next slide.
This is, despite this sort of outrage that has been growing over the past 5-10 years, other large groups of people continue to meet in private or roughly public settings. And this is a typical WTO meeting taking place in, next slide, a building that looks a bit like this. And another next slide. This shows the overall WTO complex from the air. There are 145 member countries, so they need a lot of space. It's located in Geneva, which is one of the most expensive cities on Earth, so that about 50 of these 145 member countries can't afford to keep an office in Geneva, unfortunately, and so miss out on a lot of the meetings, don't get to participate as fully as possible in this already not quite democratic process.
They also have a $100 million a year budget, and despite this sort of growing global inequity and growing public outrage over the policies of the WTO, they keep needing more space and needing to grow, and they keep pursuing these processes. So in fact, they're building an annex to this building. There's an architectural competition, and in case any of you are architects, you can enter by going to the WTO website. But they want to add another $50 million annex to this building to house more meetings and more, presumably more member countries as they add them. Next slide.
We're also thinking of building an annex.
Yeah, this is our headquarters in Milwaukee. Actually, this isn't our headquarters. We just happened to be in Milwaukee, and we saw this little building, and we thought, that looks like a nice headquarters building. We don't have a headquarters at all. We just live in our homes. This isn't even our home. Or I should say, we live in our apartments. I live in upstate New York, where I'm a teacher, and that's how I make, strangely enough, enough money to do these things, although we have gotten some little grants as well. I just save up my money from teaching so that we can, well, I'll tell you about that in a moment.
I'm teaching in Paris at the moment, and also have an apartment that's even smaller than this one. So, yeah, we're both basically downwardly mobile. Next slide, another typical scene. We don't usually sleep in the same bed, but sometimes it happens, and that's what we look like when we do.
We have more than these two blankets as well.
Yeah, this is allegory.
Yeah, this isn't the way it really is.
Don't believe it.
Let's have another slide. I imagine you might be wondering what the connection is between this huge organization whose job it is to help business, to liberalize global trade, and us, Andy and Mike, two downwardly mobile people who should. Strangely enough, we've been going around the world for the last 3 years now, representing the World Trade Organization at conferences and events all over the world, and even on prime time television.
You'll see a little more of this. Well,
yes. Soon you'll get to see him say something there.
There.
In Paris.
It really is Paris.
You're probably wondering why we should get mistaken for the World Trade Organization. So we're going to tell you how that happened.
Yeah, we said we're just downwardly mobile kind of people. Next slide. And we are, but we have some skills. Unlike a lot of the people in the world, we have internet access pretty regularly. And unlike a lot of the people, we have some time to fool around. And we've used that to sometimes build web pages, write press releases. We're pretty good at this. We've had some training, and we decided that we wanted to do something interesting with it. And so we approached this kind of online activist brokerage, next slide, called Artmark, which basically lists activist projects seeking people to accomplish them. And
so we offered our services.
We offered our services. We said, hey.
We offered to go and do things like protest on the street and stuff, but they said, well, as long as you can make web pages and as long as you might feel like you can kind of handle press releases and that sort of thing, here's a project for you. We have a domain name, and that domain name is gwbush.com, and it was offered to us by a guy who just registered it thinking that maybe it would somehow be useful because at the time, George W. Bush was running for president. And George W. Bush had a website called georgewbush.com, which I think we see the next slide.
Yeah, so talked a lot about his liberalization policies, his ideas of how free trade benefited everything, and how he was, he couched it in a lot of different terms, but basically he was saying free trade is good, and Texas, for example, benefiting from the sort of free trade policies I've instituted is the environment state.
And this is, of course, despite the fact that during the course of George Bush's governorship, Texas went from being not a very dirty air state to being the dirtiest state in the country because he stripped away all the clean air laws in that state, and that's what he's doing now nationally. So
giving full liberty to the oil companies in one way or another.
Well, we had this domain, gwbush.com, and we thought, okay, well, we need to know what to do with it, and it seems somehow obvious, but at the same time, we felt like we could get inspiration by looking at his website, which was here, and so we came up with this instead, and it looked a little bit like his website, but of course the banner's slightly different. In the upper left corner, instead of the picture of him and Laura sitting in front of the Capitol, we put a picture of him pointing at black people, and sort of poking his finger, presumably, at them. And then, we changed some of the words, and we made the stories quite different.
He boasted about some things that he wouldn't normally boast about, like, you know, is the real record of Texas as an environment state. And
we just tried to make it a little bit more honest than he usually is about his policies. And this is what we decided to do. It was a satire website.
And the idea was that people would come in and kind of read it, and they might not agree with it at first, but after spending a little time, they would accidentally learn some things. They wouldn't intend to learn when coming to it.
Yeah, the idea was to confuse people a little bit. You know, we didn't mind that people might come to this site thinking they were going to Bush's website, because we felt like maybe then we might get some people who wanted to actually, you know, communicate with George Bush.
But one person we didn't confuse was George Bush himself, who immediately sent out a cease and desist letter, had his lawyers do it, and complained to the Federal Elections Commission that we were a political action campaign and should have to pay a certain fee before we were allowed to do anything. Quite remarkable. And we sent out a big press release about this behavior, which we found amazing. And a lot of journalists found it amazing, too, wrote articles about it. And one day at a televised press conference, a journalist asked Bush, so what do you think about this website, gwbush.com? And next slide, he said, there ought to be, next slide, limits to freedom. And that, of course, was with a lot of people. And it's turned out to be strangely and horribly ominous, of course. It's a statement. Right, so next slide. This brings us back to the beginning.
Well, that the gwbush.com website and the sort of ensuing cat and mouse game that we played with the Bush campaign got a lot of press attention, and a lot of people read about it. And it also was amazing for us because we felt sort of empowered, strangely enough, to be able to suddenly raise the ire of George Bush in such a way that we were able to speak to the media and speak to massive amounts of people about how we felt about George Bush was sort of remarkable. When somebody offered us this domain, gap.org, after reading about Bush, we thought this is a perfect opportunity to really speak about the bigger problem, the problem that Bush is just a part of, which is this issue of liberalization. And of course, the GATT is the Global Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which is the predecessor organization to the World Trade Organization. The GATT was started in 1947, and then it continued up until 1995 when they founded the World Trade Organization as a way to give the GATT more powers than the previous agreements had. So the idea was to take more resources out of the public sector.
It actually has enforcement capacities, like countries can actually act to boycott various goods, to impose tariffs on goods, which under the GATT was more of just an agreement. Also, it deals with services again, as we said, water, health, and so on, which the GATT never did. But a lot of people think the GATT is the WTO. They didn't make the full transition in their minds. And still, when, you know, looking for the WTO website, might go to GATT.org.
And the next slide.
So
we put up a slide at GATT.org that looked a little bit like the World Trade Organization website. It actually looked a lot like the WTO website. This was pretty much exactly the look and feel of the WTO website at the time, including, strangely enough, that bizarre photo of the Director General of the WTO, Mike Moore. He actually wrote a book, if you can believe it, called Hard Labor, that has a picture. I mean, you know, he's a former labor leader from New Zealand, but he now is very caught up with the ideas of liberalization, so much so that he really led the charge as part of the WTO.
And on this site, we talked about liberalization in its most, in the real vanguard of liberalization, if you will, like the idea that generic AIDS drugs for Brazil would be really a crime, a kind of holocaust against the drug companies, and that, you know, letting them die of AIDS was kind of a form of tough love, and this sort of thing. Just horrifying stuff.
So the idea, I guess that's part of, like, being yes men. The idea was that we would create these websites and these sort of personas, these caricatures of the WTO that took the logic of their ideas to its conclusion. So the WTO already had a ruling that disallowed Brazil from making generic drugs to help people who had AIDS. And so, you know, they were just, all the people who were dying of AIDS there were just stuck because suddenly their drug supplies would be cut off. Well, so we decided to just speak honestly about, like, use this forum as a way to say, you know, we're the WTO and we think that those people don't matter at all. And that's what's important here is the money. And just say it frankly.
Yeah. And we thought, well, since it worked with Bush, maybe it'll work with another emblem of liberalization of the WTO. And next slide, it actually exceeded our expectations when the Director General, Mike Moore, put up a press release in the next slide announcing that we were deplorable and that we were undermining WTO transparency. These fake websites in the plural were undermining WTO transparency. So of course we were totally delighted. This was in our plan, sort of something like this. And we, but we thought, well, we'd better react immediately and directly to this accusation. Next slide, and tell who's really fake and who's really undermining transparency. WTO claims on its website to be transparent because they have 60,000 documents in 3 official languages. And if you've ever tried to read one of these, you know it's anything but transparent and doesn't really amount to much. Their actual boilerplate text on their site says something entirely different and misleading.
So we warned everybody about the WTO's misleading website.
And sent out a press release, which amused people again.
Now, this was just in the days leading up to the Seattle protests, and so we were trying to do whatever we could to sort of focus attention on what was going on in the streets. And to try to help out, even though we couldn't make it there. Luckily, we did get a lot of press coverage about it. And then after the protests, which were incredibly successful, I mean, they were able to shut down the street, shut down the meetings, actually, several of the World Trade Organization meetings. And they really focused the public attention around the world on the problem of liberalization, the problem of the WTO. So after that, we were kind of, we didn't think much, this website was going to be of much use. GATT.org, we didn't imagine that it would have much longevity after that. But as it turned out, while we were sitting at home, we started getting emails from people who thought that GATT.org was the real WTO website. They were going to GATT.org, and they weren't reading the website at all, apparently. If they had read it, they probably would have, you know, found out that it was a satire website, but instead they just would find the contact button, press it, and then write us emails, fully believing that we were the WTO.
And this is one email. We got dozens and dozens of these. And this is one. Could you advise me of the relationship of Gibraltar to the WTO sent in from the Treasury Department of the Isle of Man? And so getting this was a challenge. We immediately went to the WTO website, tried to search on their 60,000 documents and figure out what Gibraltar was and so on, and couldn't, so basically answered the question in the most straightforward way we could and said there's really no relationship. Gibraltar is a rock at the tip of Spain and the WTO is in control of world trade.
No relationship.
Did this for months, this sort of thing. And one day, an even more extreme kind of mail came in. From somebody in Salzburg for a thing called the Center for International Legal Studies, inviting us to come speak, or not us, inviting obviously Director General Mike Moore to come speak to this law conference.
So this of course presented a big, presented us with a dilemma of sorts. I mean, we obviously didn't know Mike Moore very well. I mean, he deplored us. We knew that. But, you know, it was very unlikely that even if we did send him to the conference, that he would say the types of things that we wanted him to say. We thought we had to come up with a plan B. So
we really stewed on it for like 2 months. Not actively all the time, but we did think about it for a while.
And finally, one day, it was like, hey, why don't we just send, we don't have Mike Moore, but maybe we could send Mike Moore to go instead.
similar physiology. We'd have to shave him. He probably wouldn't want to.
Yeah.
His cap and his But we did write to him. We said, Mike, will you do this? And he didn't write back.
It didn't matter. Yeah, he didn't pay attention to our emails, our pleas. You know, he probably thought we were insane, and he probably thought that he was about to become the brunt of a cruel joke, which wouldn't have happened. But nonetheless, it gave us time to think about it some more and realize that we didn't actually need a Mike Moore to do this because
We'd answered emails from whoever. We hadn't actually tried to get Mike Moore to answer emails for us, so
So instead we got a Dr. Andreas Bickelbauer, who was readily available and willing to go.
From WTO external relations, because clearly he couldn't be internal.
And so, of course, we had to somehow get to look a little bit more like Mike Moore, the first one, actually, the director general. And so we went and got business costumes at the local store. And then we went and emptied out our bank accounts because, you know, we'd been saving money for vacations of various sorts. And this seemed like a good opportunity to use that money up to go to Salzburg, Austria, to speak on behalf of the WTO. And so we got in a airplane, not quite like this one. It was a little bit slower. It had a couple, 8 propellers, I think.
Yeah, it was actually a boat. But
and went to Salzburg. And I think at this point we can show you some video documentation of this event and several subsequent lectures.
Yeah, and in this thing you'll see a lot of crazy talk. but we'd like you to keep in mind that it's not really crazy. It's kind of like the website where, you know, we talked about real things, but from a perspective, you pushed in a little way that might not be as comfortable as pleasant as it's usually cast in. So.
John Marshall Law School in Chicago.
I see. Yes.
I've been there for 18 years. I founded the International Business Law Center
School
and the only International Economic Law Master's Program in the Midwest.
Wow, that's terrific.
There are half a dozen of them.
Well, I'm afraid my own credentials are not going to quite measure up to you. But I
teach what you do. But all right.
Right. Yes, so Columbia University is my alma mater.
That'd be the JD.
Yes, that's right. JD, that's right.
So while Bickelbauer is doing his tightrope act, I go over to the conference organizers and I explain that the reason that Brian has a camera is in case of a pie attack, we can identify the assailant.
I set up the camera and started taping. I'm nervous already, and to make things worse, they're talking about us.
If you create what I call an indifference curve about language, if you can find more than one way to acceptably say the same thing, then if you can't reach agreement on one set of words, one phrase, you can reach agreement on the other, and it will mean what the parties need it to mean, and they will have the same meaning.
So, our concluding speaker is a distinguished gentleman, Mr. Andreas Bickelbauer from Vienna. He is Austrian by birth, American by training, and Austrian by habitation. Full circle. He got his Juris Doctor from Columbia University in New York, where he was a legal scholar. He has been a representative of the WTO since 1998, speaking on trade matters before a variety of forums, and is one of the authorized voices within the public relations sector of the WTO. Without further ado, Bickelbauer.
you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here in Salzburg, and I'd like to thank the organizers, the other hosts, and everybody who's taken the time to listen, even for an hour, to the messages of the WTO. We'll be talking about impediments to trade, about free trade, and our primary focus to begin with will be on a form of trade restriction simply called tariff trade barriers. And the most notorious case is the so-called honest bananas case. You all know the joke. It's not possible to kill a person by hitting that person over the head with a banana. It is, however, possible to kill a person over bananas by hitting that person over the head with a machete. Non-tariff trade barriers are a little more complicated. Customs, or simply the history and personality of locales, takes the place of government in restricting the free flow of goods and money. Not long ago, KLM and Alitalia attempted to merge. Now, in countries, people sleep at night.
Dear Alice Foley, I do not believe that any of Dr. Bickerbaum's comments at the conference led to the assault. I would note, however, that if I were Italian, I would have been very insulted by his comments.
In Italy, on the other hand, you have a totally different situation in which sleep is done during the day as much as at night, almost.
He basically stated that the KLM All-Italia merger was foiled because the Dutch were hardworking and the Italians were too lazy.
Conviviality, hilarity, there's...
This insult was compounded by the slide he showed of a sleeping Italian worker.
All of these delightful dishes that end up basically getting in the way of work. So we're faced with a situation in which everything is quite serious. Finally, we'd like to talk about the most mysterious, but strangely the most likely to be solved of all three of these kinds of barriers. And as in many cases, we can look to the private sector to see emerging solutions to the vast inefficiencies of so-called democratic institutions. One possible solution is being tested in the field of American politics to streamline the grotesquely inefficient system of elections. Let us first look at elections as they currently unroll with all of their inefficiencies in place. At the top, we have a number of corporations. Let's call them corporations A. From the corporation goes a great deal of money to a campaign. From the campaign goes a great deal of money to a PR agency. From the PR agency goes a great deal of money to TV stations, who then finally relay the information to the consumer with no transfer of money, of course. Now, on the other hand, another model. In this case, you have the corporations paying one entity. VoteAuction.com, in turn, employs only four people to transmit not merely information, but actual money directly to the consuming voter. It's a forum for people voluntarily to offer their votes to the highest bidder.
My deepest condolences to the family and friends of Dr. Bickelbauer. The only reference in his talk to voting was in the context of making markets more efficient.
Everything works out basically to the benefit of the consumers as well as the originating corporations. So, to sum up, barriers that we'd like to see put in passed for good right away are the tariff-based problems, bananas. Requiring a bit more finesse and a little more care in dealing with people-based oppositions is the second type, non-tariff trade barriers. Really present problems in Europe and everywhere. Different working habits, siestas, all of this has to be standardized, and this is a very long process. And finally, we have problems at the core of modern democracy, which could be solved by allowing the free functioning of a very competent marketplace, a free marketplace. And I like markets. I think this is what markets are for. And as you might imagine, we were a little surprised when they applauded. Surprised to even get through the speech. When we'd written it, we'd thought, well, how far will we go before they kick us out, before they, say something, before they, depending on their politeness, stop us with one degree or another of pain to ourselves. But they didn't. And then we went to lunch and tried to raised the notch a little bit and talked about the Nazis and how they had okay trade policies, really. It was all in context of something rather, but never got the slightest reaction.
Yeah, and the whole time we thought that we'd end up in jail by the end of it, but we were shocked to find out that nobody was offended by anything the WTO said, and so it became clear that the WTO could say just about anything, it seemed, and people would swallow it or would accept it because of the authority that we had as the WTO. This particular incident here in Salzburg got to be rather sordid. Eventually, trying to draw a reaction out of the participants in the conference, we actually told them that Dr. Bickelbauer had died as a result of a pie that had got thrown in his face. And all of that is actually documented in a video that we made called The Horribly Stupid Stunt, which has resulted in his untimely death, which is actually a line that was used by one of the conference delegates who was writing in some amount of despair after learning of the death of Dr. Bickelbauer, which actually made us realize that we'd overstepped the bounds of propriety with that particular event.
And we still hadn't managed to get any reaction to the voting scheme. A couple people had said the siesta thing was a little tasteless, but nobody had really taken issue with the voting scheme, and one of them even said that it was just it was in the context of making markets more efficient.
It's an acceptable way to liberalize an area that might not be a market, but maybe sometime in the future could be, which is a good thing. If
like
you can
education and health and all that.
Farm all that out to the private sector. It'll work. So we thought that after this it would put an end to these sorts of antics because the New York Times wrote an article about it. There was a lot of press about this again. Because we already had contacts from doing the GAP.org and the G.W. Bush thing, so we were able to get a bunch of interested journalists to write something.
And we spam them with press releases, so that helps too.
Yeah, and then it turned out that that despite all that attention that it was getting, people still were coming to the website and still sending in invitations to attend conferences and do lectures. And an invitation came in from CNBC, the broadcaster, asking for somebody to debate an anti-globalization activist. This is just before... just before the G8 protests in Genoa. It was, in fact, the night before the protests were supposed to begin. It was a Thursday night. They wanted a WTO delegate to go up against the World Development Movement spokesman, Barry Coates, who was going to be in London. And, we had that problem. We couldn't send Mike Moore or anybody like that. And Dr. Andreas Bickelbauer was clearly quite dead after the pie in the face. So instead, we sent Graham with Hewlett-Berry, who was, strangely enough, looking very similar to Dr. Andreas Bickelbauer. And he was actually, the rest will speak for itself, I think.
Serious about addressing the issues of world poverty, it would do things completely differently than it is now. Let me bring in Bramwith on that. Is that a fair point?
Well, of course it is, but you know, I think Barry, as well as all the other protesters, are simply, in a word, focused too much on reality and on facts and figures. And I think I would have to say that this is a long-term problem that comes down to a problem of education. We have to find a way to convince, perhaps not the protesters, but the protesters' children, to follow thinkers like Milton Friedman and Darwin and so on, rather than what the protesters have been reared on, Trotsky and Robespierre and Abby Hoffman. And I think that putting the direction of education being put into private hands, a concentration of resources in the private sector, will naturally lead to this result. And we'll see the protesters' children being reared with an entirely different set of concerns.
But let me bring you in on that.
I mean, can I just say that these kind of simplistic arguments are really, I mean, too insulting to most people to believe. You know, the fact that we have a choice between Milton Friedman or A.B. Hoffman for where we get our source of economic history and philosophy. There are many, many thinkers from around the world, just not those ones employed by the WTO, that think the World Trade Organization policies are deeply damaging for the development prospects of the poorest countries.
Let me go out to Bramwin.
Yes. Well, I wanted to speak to Granwith's, sorry, to Barry's point that there are other thinkers as well, who actually has the power in the world, and so who is correct in this kind of worldview. I mean, I think the answer is easy, and if you look at the views held by myself, my organization, and many, many of the decision makers in the world, the powerful people, they happen to coincide with what I'm explaining, and I think this is enough in this sort of view.
So, I mean, what we have here is a picture of the rich and powerful people believe a certain philosophy, which they then propound through the institutions in which they have a powerful voice. And I think this is exactly the model that is being questioned. And increasingly, what there is a very large body of people who are concerned about these rules. The people on the streets of Genoa and Seattle are not representative of the overall movement. They are the tip of the iceberg. We did a study last year that looked across developing countries and found that in the space of 1 year, in 50 protests, more than a million people from developing countries were out trying to change the rules that were being imposed on them by the World Bank and the IMF and locked in through the World Trade Organization.
Right, thank you. We must finish now, unfortunately. Barry.
Did that really happen?
No. That's not going to happen. A little confusing.
Yeah, that's
a
slightly confusing story.
Did you tell Coates afterwards that
much later, yeah. Yeah, actually that leads into what happened after this. We had a similar experience with this. You know, we thought, well, big TV audience, primetime market show will surely get some sort of reaction somehow. And perhaps there were reactions that we never heard of, but we never heard of one. And the producer even said, great to see you in the flesh finally, see your face, and sent us a copy of the tape, and it was all very pleasant, and nobody seemed to bat an eye about it.
I mean, Barry was clearly quite struck dumb by the whole experience. I mean, if you watch his reaction to what Hoolett Barry is saying, you can see the whole time that he's just making these, he can barely keep himself from busting out laughing. But he was really the only one, him and the host, Nigel Roberts, were the only ones who seemed kind of to take the thing with a grain of salt, or at least to wonder who the WTO had sent and why this time. But there was no indication that the producer or that the audience or anybody else was upset with this.
Nobody.
And so this really made us realize that there seemed like there was no way to get at that the audience was satire, that satire was not working on these on people in general. Like, they just accepted what the WTO had to say, and there was never going to be that moment of realization where the light bulb goes off and they say, and the audience realizes, oh, this couldn't be real. It must be satire. What they're saying is so horrible.
That was always our intention, was like to make them hate us first and maybe throw us out, hopefully not commit physical violence on us, but have this horror and then realize, oh, I know what they're talking about. This is what I deal with every day. And it never happened in Salzburg, didn't happen on CNBC. Of course, if we had known that it was going to be live
we might have planned something a little different. We thought it was going to be pre-recorded and would somehow have to pass to a degree, and that wasn't the case. And when I showed it to a friend of mine in San Francisco, he said, oh, you should have just shut down the WTO. You should have just announced that the WTO was seeing the failure of its policies.
Thank you, little protesters.
So in fact, we mysteriously got another invitation, and
luckily this provided the so we did end up getting the opportunity to shut down the WTO finally. A group called the CPA Australia, which is an accounting organization, was having a conference, and they asked us to give an address at the conference, or I should say asked the WTO to give an address. And this time we went in realizing that we could honestly tell them what we thought the WTO should do. So this is a little tape about that.
Some problems and everything.
Oh, it's to be expected these days, I think. No, thanks for going out of your way to arrange this. This is really terrific.
I think that was the way we did that.
Thank you all for coming. I'd like to thank the organizers, Mr. Beckingham, Ms. Canning, Mr. Percy, and CPA Australia for going out of their way to create this panel, this luncheon, in the face of some odds, the conference having been canceled, of course. And I'd especially like to begin by apologizing for a rather sudden change in the program, consequent upon a rather dramatic development in Geneva yesterday. I originally intended to transmit today an upbeat report on some new technologies that affect agribusiness in a global sense. Instead, I find myself the messenger of some rather disturbing news. The WTO will be issuing a public statement in detail by the end of the week, but the die has been cast. As of September 2002, having seen the effects of policies whose only intent was to bring greater prosperity and peace, the World Trade Organization, in its present form, will cease to exist. We of the WTO will endeavor to refound our organization along different lines, based in a different understanding of the purposes of world trade. The new organization will have as its foundation and basis the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, upon which we feel we can make a good foundation to ensuring that the organization will have human rather than business interests as its bottom line.
My reaction was one of total surprise. We're expecting a speech more based on what the World Trade Organization does and its relation to Australian trade. It sort of blew me out of the water when the announcement was made that the World Trade Organization is significantly reinventing itself to focus on issues relating to people as opposed to economics, something that hopefully could be a significant benefit to the poor and needy in throughout the world in all the developing countries.
The UN estimates that poor countries, the poorest countries in the world, lose approximately $2 billion a day because of unjust trade rules, many of them instituted by our own organization. And this is 14 times the amount that they receive in aid from developed countries.
I was astounded to find that they're actually going to dissolve the WTO. I was also amazed to see that there was an admission that perhaps it had failed.
Liberalization, the process of liberalization, often enables the knowledge of the poor to be converted into the property of global corporations. Specific statistics are rather shocking. Out of 26,000 patents applied for in Africa in 2000 and 2001, only 31 were from residents of Africa. The rest were from residents of first world countries. 31 out of 26,000 patent applications.
I think it's a very brave decision by an organisation to admit that they've been going down the wrong track and dissolve themselves and start to look for something different. I think it's fantastic.
Disparity is growing between rich and poor. The richest fifth have 80% of the world's income and the poorest fifth have 1%. This gap We all know this figure, but we don't always remember that this gap has actually doubled since 1960.
I think we're all generally aware of increases in poverty and low living standards and issues faced by developing countries. And what Mr. Spratt, I think, had to say today really gives a terrific sign of hope for what I think we all aspire to, and that's a global economy that benefits all people.
Now, after protected, protracted and detailed review of current trade policy, the World Trade Organization has decided to effect a cessation of all operations to be accomplished over the next 4 months, culminating by the end of September. The World...
Well, I think that...
All right. So let's see, at this point, we'll take questions, but we have some questions here that we'd like to hand out. You know, I mean, we trust that there will be some native questions in the room, but, you know, we like to have this be more predictable than just letting this random questions, whatever they might be. And the only thing that I ask about for when you read these questions out and is that you do it with feeling. Because we want it to be, well...
This is kind of the experience of being a yes man and saying things that are really ridiculous and that you would never say, but you have to do it convincingly.
So who would like to ask a question? All right, maybe you can... here we go. Could you please hand that one back? Hand that one back. I got to go to the middle of the room now. We got to divide this. Okay, here you go. Yes. Oh, I saw that hand really early. And, who else over, over here? Who's one? Yes. Oh, up in the back corner, please, there. Guy with a blue shirt, I guess. Oh, wait, we only have one left for this side of the room. Okay, here you go. All right, so, like, you know, we will take native questions. We may refuse to speak as well. But, yeah, please, questions. Does anybody have any questions?
No?
Somebody over there has a question. Yes.
I looked at your website, and I found myself to be floundering in a sea of confusion. I'm not sure who I am anymore. Don't you feel like you're confusing the public?
I never thought of that. Jeez.
Yeah. Well, I guess I think some famous person once said that confusion is a valuable state, and I think we agree with them because, you know, when we're confused, we're sort of activated as viewers or as listeners. We're trying to figure out what something actually means. Does anybody know who the famous person is who said that? I don't think it was Hitler. No, I think it was, I think John Cage said it. Probably somebody else said it before him, but it seems like... it seems like confusion is sort of the operative way that these sites work. People go there, they're confused, and then they either like it or they don't. But they converse with us to find out why they're confused.
Yeah, there have been studies that show that if there's a framework of understanding about something, if somebody has a basic understanding of something, no amount of facts, no barrage of or very rarely does a barrage of facts really change the perceptions, and so we hope to kind of get in the cracks of people's understanding where they're not expecting to get, you know, facts counter to what they believe. They're expecting to get something, you know, in the same same gist of what they believe, and then kind of shift it a little bit. At least that was the idea originally before we realized how fun it was to go answer questions and speak at conferences.
Are there any other questions?
Yes. May I speak? Mm. Just kind of for like general history. I was wondering, how did the WTO happen, and were cattle prods involved? Thought it would be a good idea?
Right. Well, World War II is really terrible.
Lots of bad things happened, right? And so after that, the rich countries who had won thought that, oh great, well, we're going to avoid this, and commerce is going to avoid it, because this is this theory that goes back to 18th century England, Adam Smith and all this, that you know, clients and customers, patrons and clients don't fight somehow. Despite the experience of the 19th century, in which, you know, perhaps France and Germany didn't fight so much and so on, but there were still some problems in the 19th century, like colonialization and so on, but those are really incidental problems. They didn't interfere with profit. So this was the good side of the theory for establishing the WTO, the GATT, and the IMF and the World Bank, which were part of one structure.
And they still say today that the thing that the WTO does is avoid war.
Yeah, you can
see
that.
I mean, they say that
yeah.
Good trading partners don't fight.
Right.
And you can see that, you know, and there are some breakdowns, obviously, in this theory.
But no counterpart.
I don't think anybody was forced to do this, but there's this funny thing where, you know, it was the rich who got together to decide the fate of the world through liberalization and through the WTO, as often is the case with global history. So. Any other,
I'm sure the WTO has quite powerful legal, you know, and certainly if I was them, you know, I would have my legal stuff shut you guys down in a second, you know, like, haven't they ever tried to do that?
No. Next question.
The World Trade Organization did sort of try half-heartedly to shut us down a few times by sending a legal message. You know, I think originally when Mike Moore announced that fake websites were deplorable, the idea was that somehow they would get us to back down. Each time they attacked us, we were able to take that and turn it around and use it against them and sort of tactically embarrass them. That's what we call tactical embarrassment. It's like a way to threaten to hurt somebody's reputation more by having them attack you. So they naturally back down because they're afraid that the more that they attack you, the more power they're actually giving you to criticize them. Yeah. Well, there's a question.
Do you guys have an actual website? I don't mean like the G at one.
Yeah.
I mean like a yes and a website. And where exactly do you go for it? Like teaching job-wise?
He works at a high school in upstate New York. I work at a high teaching English in Paris right now. Probably wouldn't have heard of the place, but and our website is theyesmen.org. Yeah, not theyesmen.com.
Do you operate the website, or is that done by like the president?
George Bush does that website, yes, in his spare time. George Bush does our website. It's like a secret.
What was your reaction to you guys shutting down the WTO? Like when the person was reading the thing, it sounded like he was like.
Those people were thrilled, of course, the people at the conference. That was kind of the wonderful thing about it.
But like afterwards, like in the media, like I'm sure it got reported, and the people who were speaking afterwards
in the Canadian Parliament.
In the Canadian Parliament. Well, before any articles got written about it, the journalists did a bit of research and found out that it wasn't quite the case. In fact, the WTO responded to that by saying, these guys are really funny. They're not deplorable anymore. That was their initial reaction, and they saw the result of that, the media loving that. So they said, these guys are really great and funny. But it's not true that the WTO is shutting down.
And by the end of that session, one of the aides to John Duncan had told him already that he was wrong and that it was a hoax email. And so John Duncan actually announced that, unfortunately, it wasn't true, that the World Trade Organization still exists.
But the people there really just, you know, it was like, just broke that little shell of something that keeps it all in place, and they just, at least momentarily for a few minutes there for a few people, and they just were overflowing with good suggestions. They suggested locating the headquarters of the WTO in a third world country so that more countries could have a permanent presence there and maybe participate more. All kinds of ideas came out of them, so that was kind of interesting. Accountants.
Do you guys have any plans for the future? Are you like still getting invitations, or has it pretty much like stopped?
No invitations.
No more. No. At this point, like, your reputation is.
Seems like it, yeah.
What are you doing with money from talks like these? Is it just personal, or are you planning something?
Oh,
wonderful?
This. Wow.
We're, well, a couple things. First of all, we're doing a book.
Oh, yeah.
And well, right now, there's a guy up there making a film. That's part of the reason we're here doing this talk. Once we get those out of the way, there's a whole bunch of sort of projects are still, I guess, that are still ongoing. Like, we have a Dow Chemical website called dow-chemical.com. Actually, it was dow-chemical.com. It no longer exists because Dow was able to grab the web, that domain back. But so we have a couple of other campaigns going on, and I guess part of the idea of the Yes Men is that, we essentially don't have any special talents or skills. This is the type of thing anybody could do who wants to go and, let's say, participate in the masquerade, you know, put on a mask and whether it's create a false website or just go to some of these conferences and find out, well, you know, what kind of gears are in place behind the sort of facade.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're trying to, in part, to do the tour to encourage people to go to these conferences, or at least to try to intervene in spaces that might otherwise not, you know, provide an opportunity for somebody with our opinions to go and speak.
At the beginning, I kind of like pretended like all this liberalization stuff and, you know, that we talked about was really informing our practice and so on. It is, in retrospect, but along the way, it's just been accident after accident. We've never really had a coherent plan. Action. Things have just happened, and then we've realized they're valuable sometimes, or not.
Even though it seems terribly unpopular these days, I'm really concerned about rights. What gives you the right to do these things?
Sure. We've asked lawyers. They don't seem to know whether it's illegal, but that's not the question.
Well, you know, I guess we don't have any more right to do this than anybody else, but we believe that everybody should have the right to determine what's right for themselves, as long as it doesn't infringe on anybody else's rights, and we didn't think that this infringed on anyone's rights when we were doing it, so, yeah, in short, you know, we haven't grappled with the hard ethical questions yet, but thank you for asking that, because now we can go home and think about it and discuss it and do a lot of soul searching.
It's about time.
I have two questions. The first one is, I had seen some article about some kind of stunt you pulled in the big gold suit on.
Yeah, the big gold suit with the penis and like television zapping.
Mm.
Oh,
weird.
It's funny. Huh. Anybody else? Oh, yeah. Okay.
Well, I couldn't help noticing, even from all the way back here, you guys really smell. How do you survive and make money and, you know, go to these conferences with such a bad body odor?
Right. Well, fortunately, on the airplane, they have this amazing air circulation system. So we've almost always have been able to get there once we've gotten on. And the price hasn't increased, which makes it affordable for your average middle class first worlder to do this kind of thing. It's just like a vacation.
Oh, yeah.
Wait. Yeah?
Please, speak a little about 3-foot-long phalluses. This is a subject that interests me very much.
This is a pandemic. Jeez.
All right.
3-foot-long
golden phalluses.
All right.
It's funny you should ask, because, and it's funny that you should ask, too, just before telling us we smelled, because we do have a videotape about a World Trade Organization plan for a thing called the Employee Visualization Appendage, which is a way for managers of factories to control remote workforces. So no matter where people are in the world, in sweatshops, managers, through this device, will be able to control them and administer electric shocks. And we were able to unveil this technology at a conference in Finland called the Textiles to the Future Conference that made the same mistake as everybody else did, who invited the WTO at the website gat.org, And they invited us to go and give a lecture, actually the keynote address to the conference. And so the WTO did something appropriately textilic. And here's a little tape about it.
Oh, this was a long lecture. This is just the tail end. Not the tail end.
How does a manager maintain proper rapport with the workers? And how does he or she ensure from a distance that workers perform their work in an ethical fashion? Mike, would you help me a moment? This is much better, much more comfortable. This is the WTO's answer to two of the major management problems, and we're calling it the management leisure suit. It's the two problems again, how to maintain close rapport with distant workers, and how to remain comfortable and increase leisure activities. How does the management leisure suit work, besides being extremely comfortable, as I can guarantee you? Well, allow me to describe the suit's core features. Visualization appendage. It's an instantly deployable, hip-mounted device with totally hands-free operation that allows the manager to see his employees directly right here. Signals communicating the exact amounts and quality of physical work are transmitted not only visually right here, but directly through electric channels implanted directly into the manager. The workers, for their part, are fitted with corresponding transmitting chips that are implanted humanely directly into the shoulder. But the other equally important achievement of the MLS has to do with leisure. In the United States, leisure, another word for freedom really, has been decreasing steadily since the 1970s. The management leisure suit permits the manager to reverse this trend by letting him do his work anywhere while remaining in complete touch with the workers, physically sensing what's going on in the workforce on the floor through channels implanted directly into the manager. Again, the manager sees the employees, but also feels what they're feeling and can select where to focus in the workplace environment. So, in conclusion, I'd like to ask, is this a science fiction scenario? The answer is no. Everything we've seen here, everything we've been talking about, is entirely possible today. We can always look forward on the highways of progress towards ever new horizons with cooperation and mutual delight in the fruits of prosperity. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you very much.
You can see from this that we didn't immediately abandon the idea of trying to get through a satire, to get through to people with satire. I mean, this was, we went to some pretty extreme lengths to try to convince people that we were not the WTO at all, but we were highly critical of them. But even at this event, people did not respond negatively to this image of the WTO.
This was after the CNBC thing and before the Australian account.
What did they say about
the suit? Not much. They were pleasant. People seemed a little bemused, maybe not quite sure what to make of it. But nobody, I asked about five people if they had seen anything really horribly wrong with the lecture. And, one woman was very upset because she could barely talk about it. She was so upset.
and we finally got her to say that why she didn't like it. And she said, well, it's not fair. And I said, what, fair? Not fair to who? And she said, well, to factory owners, to female factory owners. You know, it's the metaphor, it's this. And it turned out that she would have been comfortable with another metaphor or something. Just that it limited the field of factory ownership in the third world. So.
Did you hang out in the suit for a while afterwards?
Yeah.
Fully inflated?
Yeah. Well, it sags after that.
Is it really terribly comfortable?
Immensely yeah. Comfortable.
Really horrible.
Where did you get that?
A friend of his made it.
Where can we get that?
George Michael has an extra copy.
All they do is send you an email, and you reply via email, and that's all the exchange that they have. You really?
Yeah.
No
yeah.
Phone calls.
Yeah, phone call once with Australia. We had to talk on the phone.
Yeah.
I think that was the only phone call. Yeah. Yeah.
In the back.
Yeah. Had a question about your thoughts on something in the wake of like a huge anti-globalization movement that's really scared elites, I think, in a lot of ways, which is kind of really sort of transferred into an anti-war movement. And Thomas Friedman in 1998, he's a columnist in the New York Times, said that the hidden hand of the market cannot work without the hidden fist, right, of the U.S. military. I think we're seeing the hidden fist apparent in Iraq right now. I'm just wondering, within the context, I noticed that your activism and your actions are sort of within the context of a greater movement, right, the anti-globalization movement. And if you could talk about the significance and the role that students can play in these larger movements, and maybe why we should get involved.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah, one immediate answer comes to mind is that in our experience doing this, we never got a reaction out of any of these audiences of people who work in these fields all the time. It's people who are used to this stuff, who you would hope would have some kind of a conscience, who would be aware of things. We did a lecture for some students at one point, a horrifying lecture, but before it could even get horrifying, the students were horrified. At the parts where it was about as horrifying as the lecture in Salzburg or Finland, the students were already practically throwing things, clearly very upset, disgusted. And so in our experience, it seems to be the only population that's actually paying attention, maybe. And traditionally, it's been among students that changes happened historically. So you can just look, you know, where is it likely to happen? Maybe among people who are occupied mainly in learning and thinking.
Yeah, so I think, some things to do immediately are go and check out, you know, let's say, for example, ProtestNet or a whole bunch of other websites that are serving as kind of hubs for organizing, and try to figure out where, if you don't fit in some way already, try to figure out where you might fit in or what kinds of things you might end up doing. I mean, we just sort of happened into this kind of activity by accident, you know, after sort of just feeling like we had to do something. And chances are that if you just start trying out a bunch of different things, you'll end up finding an affinity group to work with, or let's say, you know, it might be a large group that's involved in street protest. It might be, let's say, a smaller cell that's doing something else.
It could even be just you, you know, doing something. It's a great moment to, you know, when you have weeks and at a time to think about things, or at least some time to think about things. You'll have it later too, of course, but
it's just so crazy right now. I mean, with the war does change things completely. Like, we don't really know where to put this presentation anymore, you know, because in the last 3 weeks, things have changed so dramatically that in some ways, the using humor to sort of get underneath the radar of social acceptability, to like get into the no-fly zone of people's imaginations, is no longer functioning temporarily. I mean, we'll see. I think there's a point at which it gets funny again, but you know, it's at this point, it's just like in the face of such a disastrously violent, action, it's kind of hard to even like still use humor. And so I don't know, like we're searching for what to do. You know, go to we try to go to protests ourselves, try to do whatever we can to aid other groups that are doing something that we consider to be useful.
A lot to think about right now. The whole basis of it is shifting and changing. Like just a couple of years ago, there was a book, Empire, written about the anti-globalization movement, basically, and this empire was sort of metaphorical. Of course, now it's not metaphorical anymore suddenly at all. I mean, even the people behind it are calling it imperial. So, you know, things are shifting, and it's really a moment for people who spend a lot of time thinking and have time to do things, have the energy to do things.
Are there any yes women in
it? It's funny you should mention that. On the website homepage, it says, the Yes Men are a genderless, loose-knit association of some 300 imposters worldwide. And this is only partially untrue. We don't have 300 people participating, but there are women who do these sorts of things. For the WTO actions, there haven't been any women who've been participating in the sort of, who've been going and representing the WTO. And if you look around in the meetings, you know, it seems pretty clear why. You know, we're trying to go undercover there, you know. So like Andy, you know, he was the natural to do this because he has a few gray hairs and stuff and can wear a business suit and look like the other suits, sort of. like there's a woman in LA who is doing some sort of undercover stuff with eToys when the Yes Men have been doing stuff for a while, and she poses as a TV producer and got inside of the eToy Corporation during a thing called the Toy War. And there's sort of continual opportunities. It's just, see what happens.
Unfortunately, it's the expression that best represents what we do, I think.
The Yes Men name is, you know, even though that's gender specific.
Just going back to the previous question about the, you know, what you're saying is that what you're doing is, in a sense, bringing out obscenity of the discourse of WTO, and even when you do it, it doesn't come out, but still that there was some effectivity in what we saw. The problem today, just to think about what you said about imperialism, that, you know, even the mainstream discourse is acknowledging this, and also, you know, dominant discourse today, in a sense, saying, yes, we should do this, we should get the oil price down. You know, you can hear in classrooms, you know, these types of arguments sometimes. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, the obscenity becoming to the main stage right now, that there's no fly zone, no, has disappeared. In a sense, the place which you were working on has disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we have to devise new stressless interventions.
Yeah. Constantly. I mean, even as we were doing these, we consistently found that things that we had thought were satirical turned out to be superseded in reality. Like in the Salzburg lecture talking about banning the siesta, somebody actually, the president of Mexico outlawed the siesta in government offices, and Berlusconi wanted to ban the siesta in Italy, and then, you know, the privatizing voting. We hadn't really thought about this GATS and, you know, the privatizing of services, but if you think about it, it's not actually much further than that. And there, you know, some of these things that it could lead to are totally absurd. So yeah, constantly have to kind of keep ahead of reality somehow. And now it's harder than ever. Yeah.
Yeah, we do definitely have to re-strategize, though. It's like,
yeah, it's kind of sudden. It's like 3 weeks now.
We've gotten a huge increase in hate mail in the last 3 weeks too, which is interesting. It's always right after September 11th, there was a spike, and now there's a spike again, which seems interesting. Another barometer. Yeah.
I guess kind of riding on that, like, how do you create new types of like strategies within such like incredible propaganda and like such like obvious propaganda? Whereas, like, what you're dealing with before is kind of loose, and a lot of people didn't know about the WTO, a lot of people didn't know what the propaganda was. Whereas now it's, like, fed to us daily. How would you say that you have to, like, is there a way to, like, you know, get around that, or?
I think it was fed to us daily before, too, just not in this violent, particularly bloody form, but the ideology of liberalization was always, you know, that's been the main discourse for 50-100 years.
And this is the thing that, yeah, it's really important. Maybe this is a valuable thing to do, is to try to point out the way that this kind of like, let's say, bending of the truth, or bending of the media, is something that was going on previously, but it was going on with this kind of low level violence, or this sort of let's call it endemic violence. The way that they talk about endemic hunger versus starvation. It's just endemic hunger is kind of like this long-term starvation that people have to suffer with incessantly. And, you know, there is a sort of endemic violence of liberalization, and it's what we learn, it's what I learned going to school, you know, in public schools. I just learned that growth was good, you needed it. You know, you need a healthy economy, because a healthy economy is what gives everybody jobs and what creates growth. And it's this kind of logic that if you don't have continual growth, and that if you don't have continual development, there's going to be some kind of catastrophe. That's the main sort of problem. It's the core of it all. And, you know, until we can cast off that core belief system, I mean, it is like this belief system that we're in, and especially in the United States, that until we can do that, it seems like we'll continue down that path. You know, whether or not we're getting the truth or not about what's going on in Iraq, we still have this basic problem, which is a collision course with a destiny that looks rather, you know, in which the Earth is just completely used up.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. And these behaviors that we've engaged in have never been really, you know, effective on the level of, you know, say, giant protests, of course. They've not at all, you know, there's... Maybe for two people doing it, it's proportionately pretty effective, but it's never been very effective, really. So now I think it has the same place, maybe within whatever's going to happen now, within whatever resistance is going to develop. Maybe it has the same kind of supporting role, this sort of thing. I don't think there's anything about the bloodiness of it that diminishes its potential to... satire, or whatever you want to call it, to shock people into seeing things differently.
What's that? Yeah, maybe just a few more. Just a few more questions?
A few more, so we have time for a few more questions. Maybe three more? How's that?
Three more.
Yeah, sure. Is that a hand back there? Stretching?
You have to answer.
Oh, he's got one. It's a prepared question.
I'm going anywhere yet. Please speak to me about the WTO is planning to solve world hunger by having poor people eat their own shit.
It's funny you should ask.
Well, we do have a video, but it's a little long.
well, it'll be the last thing that we show.
Yeah.
Is the
we
video.
We can show it as people file out. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, we should play. All right, we'll take one more question, and then we'll go back to this question of how the WTO plans to solve world hunger. All right. Yes?
You, Andy, are a terrific actor.
Oh,
really
terrific. Thank you very much.
Bravo.
Thanks.
What hope, really, is there for someone who is not such an exceedingly talented actor such as yourself? Mm. How could a bad actor like me succeed at what you do?
Right. Well, try saying bravo. Bravo!
Bravo!
Andy, you're great.
You're great, Andy.
Thank you. well, actually, it's really easy. It's not acting at all. It's the funny thing when... it's probably obvious, actually. It's really stupid question.
What a stupid question.
Not, like,
what?
Did you find it hard to not crack?
I mean, the scary thing is that he actually sort of becomes these horrible WTO characters.
Yeah.
It's not really a conscious Stanislavski thing. It's not like he's trained in acting in that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that he becomes the character, and afterward, it's very hard to get him out.
Yeah.
So,
and it's
like,
sort of natural. I mean, everybody does it constantly. You know, you're constantly becoming something. And the hard thing about acting is when people don't believe that you are what you are, you have to suspend that disbelief, and so you have to work really hard and convince yourself and
do all this Stanislavski. But if everybody in the room believes that you're something, then you just kind of act like that. And you can't help yourself.
And no matter what you do, you're still going to be acting well because they all believe you're who you are.
Yeah.
So, like, for instance, right now, if you were to know that this isn't Andy at all, you know, that it's like, that this is a World Trade Organization representative, it would suddenly shatter your illusions about Andy. But since you know that it's Andy, it's
I find it really easy to act like a left-wing kind of, you know, because you all think I
am. How do you create the names for your characters?
Yeah, so, well, there's a lot of telephone book and gematria, you know, the numerology kind of thing. The word so that the beast. No, it's there were no Granwiths in the internet. I don't know. That's the fun part.
Yeah.
Had to create new names because the old ones were not only dead, they were on the internet at that point, so I had to consistently come up with new ones.
And you know, if the name isn't interesting enough, nobody's going to believe it's a WTO representative, right? You can't just be like Joe Smith and be a W. You have to have a international sounding name, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
What are some of your other
Mike Moore?
Yeah, for example. Yeah, typical international name like Mike Moore.
Mike Moore. There's Kinnithurung Sprat, Food Fish. That one's.
How many of these actions have you done?
Well, there was Salzburg, CNBC, Finland, the students, and the thing. Yeah, the Sydney, Australia, five.
Do you have any coming up?
Not that we know of.
Or you're still running GAD, though?
Yeah, it's still up there. You just don't get any mail anymore.
Right.
Maybe you could be an embedded reporter.
Yeah.
Frontline globalization.
Today we read a story about an embedded reporter who reported on the rents on a group of Marines, I guess, who happened to cross one of the palaces of the sons of Saddam Hussein, and they had a chicken feast. They ate his chicken. That's what we read today. That was the embedded report. Anyway, on that note, maybe
being in bed with a military battalion, you get to eat the chicken. So, somebody asked about feeding poor people shit and solving starvation. So, this was a kind of control group, basically, that was mentioning students and our experiences with them. This is the control group that makes us think that it's something about experts who spend a lot of time in these things that makes them impervious to the satire. This is the tail end of the lecture again. There was a whole bunch of horrifying stuff before. That's nothing. Oops. Say there are problems. There are invading armies. There are big blockades. And one of the problems that we run into in this crusade is starvation in the third world. You may recognize that symbol from those green bins you see, you know, where cans, bottles, blah, blah. The kind of recycling I'm talking about, recycling what counts, where it counts. To begin to understand the theory behind this, you must first realize that the human body is not really very efficient. When ingesting heavy foods, only about 20% of the nutrients are absorbed by the alimentary passageway, while the other 80% finds itself expelled in post-consumer byproducts. Already 20 years ago, NASA scientists began to tap into this nutritional gold mine by developing filters that could transform their astronauts' waste into healthy, hygienic, and even delicious food once again. With the use of this technology, a single hamburger, for example, can be eaten more than 10 times, providing a cumulative total of 3 times the nutritional value of the original fresh hamburger. And I'd love to take any questions. Yes, you've been...
Coming from a third world country, I found most of what you said pretty offensive. It's as if everyone is equal, but some are more equal than others. And who is to say whether people in the third world want a burger?
You know, I in my heart sometimes find it to agree that
cultures deserve equal consideration, perhaps to develop on their own terms, but, you know, we're different. We're culturally different. We're rich, they're poor. This is the only solution to come up with. It stays within the market logic.
If it's all right, I could answer a portion of that question as well. We do have a kind of video presentation about this that I came prepared to show. So as you can see here, there's a consumer in the first world entering McDonald's and consuming a hamburger. And afterward, this is a process we're all familiar with. I don't need to explain it to anyone. But you see, it's rendered out in this style because studies have shown that consumers are most responsive to 3D animation right now, particularly in developing cultures. So as you can see, it goes through a piping system, a kind of, and this isn't unusual. We do this for oil. We could do this for food as well. And as you can see, it goes back up through the plumbing and emerges in a McDonald's. The number one, number two, number three, number four, number five would no longer refer to combinations of food, but rather just the number of times the product had been recycled.
I think you guys, the WTO is kind of lacking a kind of like a human element, you know, like have you ever seen starving people?
In pictures, yes.
If you saw somebody starving to death, you would probably think a lot, you know, like that would kind of hit you in a sensitive, you know, place to say like, oh, well, you know, maybe markets and money and this and that don't really mean as much, and actually like feeding people means a little bit more, you know?
Well, you know, yes, probably if I went to these countries, I'd think about things a little differently, perhaps. But we are able, fortunately, to simply direct world trade in a much more theoretical way in collaboration with our colleagues at the largest corporations. So perhaps one day I'll do that.
This is a moneymaker, correct?
Yes. Well, it's a moneymaker, starvation solver, sure.
And how much does McDonald's pay you to come here and speak this garbage you
are? Did I see a mouse with an ear growing out of its back? How do you get around cultural and legal implications of cannibalism and basically asking us to recycle shit?
I think that's all mystical behavior. I mean, you don't have models, that's what I think. But I can't help but feel burned.
The reality is that we already treat people in the third world far worse than we treat our domestic animals. It's not saying it's right. It's just saying that's the reality.
If anybody wants to leave, you can leave, and if you want to stay and ask more questions, we can,
keep going. So can we just have a formal answer? People can leave if they need to. So Andy and Mike, the S-Men.